Hello, this is Harrison, and welcome to the very first episode of One Awareness at a Time podcast. Where we are going to be talking about wide-ranging topics surrounding the issues you may not be familiar with before. So, we are going to be talking about conversational narcissism. And we are going to be answering these following questions. The first one, what is a conversational narcissism? Like, what is the definition and how can we recognize it? The second one, if it is such a bad habit, what can we do to avoid it? And the third one, what should we do if our conversational partner is a conversational narcissist? And the last one, why us being sympathetic can be regarded as just another expression of conversational narcissism. So in the last segment, we are going to be talking about why saying I know exactly how you feel is the worst. Now you're curious, right? Okay, so without further ado, let's just dive right in into the very first question. What is a conversational narcissism? So, having a constructive, engaging, and undiscriminating conversation is still one of the most effective ways to broaden our perspective and to get more in touch with our sense of humanity. Quoting journalist Celeste Headlee, a good conversation is like a game of catch. In a game of catch, you cannot possibly throw more than you catch. But the truth is, everybody desires to be in control of his own narrative so that he won't have to listen to the opposing perspectives. So maybe it is time for us to scrutinize the driving force behind our determined necessity to have a conversation. Are we looking for dominance and validation, or are we preparing to learn something? But, Harrison, wait a minute. It feels so satisfying and delightful to talk about ourselves, isn't it? So just let me give you an example. Like, when your friend shares his personal experience of dealing with, let's say, demanding boss and intensifying workload, what would be your very first response? If we are being honest, my very first response would be, my mind automatically races through memory lane to seek similar experiences, and then I rest my back on a chair and feeling proud of myself a little bit, and then I observe and I wait impatiently to jump right in and tell that similar story of mine. And don't tell me I'm the only one who does that, because you know what? A recent study by Harvard discovers that talking about ourselves activates areas in our brains that have been linked to pleasurable feelings associated with stimuli such as sex, cocaine, and good food. So, concisely, telling people about how fucked up our life is makes us feel fantastic. Wow. this tendency to continuously define each conversation as an invaluable opportunity to showcase just how relatable you are, to brag about how deep you understand about stuff, and to purposefully shift the focus of the exchange to yourself is called conversational narcissism. So if you are familiar with the example I mentioned earlier, well, yes, you are a conversational narcissist the whole time. But that's okay, because the thing about conversational narcissism is that it is often subtle. We acknowledge that it is rude to not show interest in what other people have to say, so we carefully express ourselves in such a way to not be labeled selfish. So, how are we able to recognize when we are being a conversational narcissist? Like, what are the characteristics? So that's coming up after the break. Okay, so here we are back again. So now we are moving into the question, how we can recognize when we are being a conversational narcissist? Like, what are the characteristics? So a sociologist, Charles Durber, distinguishes shift response from support response. So to put it into context, I'm going to give you two quick illustrations of the use of each response on a daily conversation. So, example 1. Peter says, "I'm so tired lately." And Sean replies, "Oh yeah, so am I. I slept for only 2 hours last night, and now I'm basically a zombie." And now example 2. Robert says, "Oh, I'm feeling so stressed at work. My boss just keeps throwing tantrum for no apparent reason." And Jack replies, "Have you considered resigning?" So, in example 1, Sean's response is identified as a shift response, whereas Jack's response in example 2 is a support response. Durber said that the main characteristic to recognize whether a conversational narcissism is on its way to sabotage the conversation you are having right now is the preferential use of shift response and the underutilization of support response. Do you still remember the example 1? Okay, so let's hear example 1 again. Example 1. Peter says, "I'm so tired lately." And Sean replies, "Oh yeah, so am I. I slept for only 2 hours last night, and now I'm basically a zombie." You notice how Sean, in example 1, immediately tries to shift the focus of the conversation to himself. And let's hear example 2 once again. Robert says, "Oh, I'm feeling so stressed at work. My boss just keeps throwing tantrum for no apparent reason." And Jack replies, "Have you considered resigning?" You can see how Jack asks Robert a question as a response to encourage Peter to elaborate his current state of mind. So, that kind of response sends an underlying message to Robert that somebody is listening. So now we are able to make a difference between a shift response and a support response. And I find an interesting thing about our ways to enable conversational narcissism. Sometimes we somehow always manage to discover fast alternatives to fulfill our interest, don't we? We might hide our attempt to take over the conversation under the camouflage of artificial supportive remarks at first. So, what are artificial supportive remarks? Artificial supportive remarks includes but is not limited to words of vague encouragement, such as, yep, that's true, oh yeah, oh yes, and etc. And seemingly passionate smile or laughter. Let me give you an example of the use of these artificial supportive remarks. So, like when a friend of yours is telling his ideology of love, like his ideal type of a perfect spouse, let's say you are not interested in hearing what he has to say. So, because you don't want to be selfish, you don an enthusiastic expression for 5 minutes, and then you strengthen your back, you look at him in the eye, and there is a voice echoing in your mind saying, "You better prepare for my ultimate revenge. So, that kind of interaction, merely too hostile and unnecessarily competitive sequences of seizing attention, which is unhealthy and has strayed far away from the core essence of how a conversation should be carried out. The quality of a conversation is dependent on the stimulating interactivity among all participants involved, who gear up to acquire new knowledge and treat opposing perspectives as resources to challenge our current approach to issues. So, if your definition of a conversation involves the act of recounting experiences, explaining theories, and handing out unsolicited advice while expecting other people to pay uninterrupted attention, well, you may be referring to preaching,
but nevertheless, you are what you are, and he
blogging, vlogging.
Hello everyone, this is Jake here.
Not a conversation. Session. So now we have reached the end of the first segment, where we have answered the question, what is a conversational narcissism? We have learned how conversational narcissism can be heavily involved in the overall pattern of the ways we have a conversation by understanding the distinction between support response and a shift response. And then we examine which response we often use, and we restrain our impulse to talk about ourselves. And now, we are moving into the second question. If it is such a bad habit, how can we break out of it? And that's coming up after the break. Okay, back with me again, Arison, and now we are going to be answering the second question. How can we avoid conversational narcissism? So the first one, default focus to restrain your mind from wandering when you are listening. Most of the times, our attention span is sharply reduced because we are distracted by the urge to collect experiences similar to the one our conversational partner is telling us right now. The result is partial understanding of the context of the story we are hearing, which shows the lack of enthusiasm we have for our conversational partner. Most of the times, we only care about our own stories, and that is one of the many factors that triggers a conversation to end abruptly. The second one, let your curiosity spark off your interest in discovering and absorbing new and unfamiliar pieces of information. That curiosity should be guarded by and filtered through your sense of empathy to acknowledge the boundaries and limitations you should not cross, as it would violate somebody's privacy and prompt other people to interpret your attitude as simply crass, out of place, humiliating, and disrespectful. The third one, honestly articulating your concerns when you stumble upon obstacles which disrupt the course of the conversation. For instance, when a misunderstanding quickly morphs a conversation into a personal debate, take a pause and assuredly say, "I am sorry to have responded in such harsh manner. I believe there is a major misunderstanding and I'm willing to resolve that." So we're gonna take turns to share interpretations of the statements each of us has told the other. And if I misread your intent, please correct me. Or when a term you are not familiar with is being discussed, it is advised to ask your conversational partner to explain it briefly. You may be afraid of being mocked at because you are not aware of such a trivial matter, but sustaining a conversation when you are clearly uninformed about particular issues that is being discussed, it bears no values for yourself. The fifth one, maintaining open-mindedness. When a new perspective contradicts the collection of beliefs we base our principles on, it is crucial to suppress rising judgments born out of defensiveness of the beliefs we hold on to for so many years. So, maybe it is time for us to take into consideration that every story, every theory, every opinion might possess some elements of truth waiting to be unraveled. And the last one, give back the spotlight. An entrenched habit that's been reinforced for so many years requires extra effort and firm commitment to be dismantled. So it is only normal, like when you are in the middle of a conversation and you unintentionally find yourself passionately talking about yourself just because you want to get the attention, or maybe you aim to build a foundation and to paint a bigger picture in order to get your point across a lot easier, but you end up talking about your own experiences, well, just give back the spotlight. Okay, we have reached the end of the question 2, how we can avoid conversational narcissism. And now, we are moving into the third segment, where we are going to be answering the question, what should we do if our conversational partner is a conversational narcissist? And that is coming up after the break. And we are back again in the very first episode of One Awareness at a Time podcast with me, Arison. And I'm just so psyched that you are still here with me. So we are going to be talking about the third question. What should we do when we find out that our conversational partner is a conversational narcissist? You still remember the conversation between Robert and Jack? Let's hear it back again. Robert says, "Oh, I'm feeling so stressed at work. My boss just keeps throwing tantrums for no apparent reason." And Jack replies, "Have you considered resigning?" Okay, so Jack is providing a support response, right? But what if Robert is not as considerate as we think he is? What if, as the conversation progresses, he turns out to be one of the self-centered bastards who is obsessed and determined to draw attention to himself and who is not willing to give up the spotlight? Like, he's gonna gab about how much he hates his job right now, and you're gonna just sit there and be a good friend, and you're gonna nod your head, and you're gonna agree with every single thing he says, and you're gonna ask him questions to keep him talking. Well, again, a good conversation is like a game of catch. If you notice the tendency of the conversation to only greatly benefit one person and leave the other people feeling dissatisfied or unmotivated, then walking away is a necessary action. How to do it, you ask? Be honest. "I'm sorry, I do not think this is working for me. I feel like this conversation is going nowhere because I do not see any exchanges of ideas or thoughts happening, and I'm gonna go now." And congratulations, you just saved yourself from imminent waste of time, energy, and focus. Hooray! If the other person adamantly refuses to value your presence as an individual who has unique and distinct thoughts and way of thinking, then it simply means he cares for no one but himself, and you just gotta walk away. Bye, Felicia. Ho 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 ho. Okay, now we have reached the end of the third segment where we have answered the question, what should we do when we find out that our conversational partner is a conversational narcissist. And now we are moving into the last segment. Why saying "I know exactly how you feel" is the worst? Why us being sympathetic can be regarded as just another expression of conversational narcissism? And that is coming up after the break. And now we are back again, and we are at the last segment. How our sympathetic decorum can be an extension of our subconscious tendency to enable conversational narcissism. So I'm just gonna give you a scenario. Music. No, I mean like bedtime story music. Yes, okay, keep going. So one afternoon, after long hours at work, you are joining your friends at a cafe for a dinner. John, a friend of yours, tells you about the unexpected death of his beloved dog, and a single tear is running down his cheek. Okay, I don't want to get into it. Okay. So as he tells his story, you recall how broken and desperate you were when a car accident took your dog's life 2 years ago. So the question becomes, how will you respond to John's story? Speaking from my experience and my perspective, I've always had two rules I abided by. So the first one, I dig deep into my memory to accumulate similar experiences. I thought by doing it, I would offer the impression like this moment of grief is not exclusively reserved for you only. I have been through it and I survive. The second one, I nod my head and I say, I understand how it feels like when I share those experiences which entail hopeful messages at the end, which is just the worst. So basically, I was giving away unsolicited advice like, I have found my calling and it's to fucking save the world. But let's reverse the role. Like, what kind of responses do you truly expect when you decide to confide in your circle and openly share your grief over the loss of, let's say, a beloved pet? Do you want people to come up to you and say, I know exactly how you feel, and then they take turns recounting their similar experiences in order to make you feel less pressured about your own situation? Or do you wish they would just sit down and listen? I personally prefer the latter, because despite all the commonality of traits, of interest, and of experiences we share with our closest friends, we have zero idea about how other people approach, process, and ascribe meaning to a tragedy. So the truth is, we do not know how they feel. Saying, I know exactly how you feel, is the worst. Because, number one, we do not know how they feel. In an article published on ideas.ted.com, Celeste Headlee wrote that in order to apprehend a new piece of information, our brain initiates a process during which all relevant experiences are accumulated to provide context to the information. This collection of relevant experiences should be intended only for the purpose of making sense of what our senses perceive. It should not be determined as a standard by which we assess and we judge how deserving our friend is of our sympathy. Let's say a friend just lost a dog he has taken care of for 4 years. So just because you previously lost a dog that has lived with you for 8 years, it doesn't mean the sorrow you felt is much more intense than the sorrow your friend is currently feeling. The second one, each experience is individual. By saying we know how they feel, we are suggesting that we dismiss their experience as just yet another similar experience of the one we have dealt with before. We are ignoring the complexity, the gravity, and the weight of the burden of the profound grief our friend is carrying. And I'm sure that is not the kind of impression we'd like to get across, especially when your initial intention is to provide comfort. And the third one, most of the times, it ends up with us talking about ourselves all over again. Yes, that is right. Remember the Harvard study I mentioned earlier, which discovered that talking about ourselves makes us feel fantastic? So we are the ones who feel good. We are the ones who walk away from the conversation absorbing joy, not the person who involuntarily listens to our story. For all we know, he might be walking home, growing a lot more despondent, and probably thinking, "Oh my god, why can't that asshole just shut the fuck up?" Sometimes the only form of support we seek when we eventually decide to reach out to our friends is for them to listen, period. When there is no specific request heard from your friend to recall and share your similar experience, it is usually a very obvious sign for you to eradicate the tempting urge to talk about yourself. You can just say, "There is no way for me to understand how you're feeling right now. I hope things are going to be better. And if you ever need someone to talk to, do not hesitate to reach out." So now we have reached the end of the last segment, where we have answered the question, why saying "I know exactly how you feel" is the worst. We are moving into the conclusion segment, where I'm going to be summarizing all the answers to all the four questions. And that is coming up after the break. Hello, welcome back again, and now we have arrived at the conclusion segment. So, the first question, what is a conversational narcissism, and how can we recognize if we are being a conversational narcissist? Conversational narcissism is the tendency to continuously define each conversation as an invaluable opportunity to showcase just how relatable you are, to brag about how deep you understand about stuff, and to purposefully shift the focus of the exchange to yourself. Charles Durber said that the main characteristic to recognize whether a conversational narcissism is on its way to sabotage the conversation you are having right now is the preferential use of shift responses and the underutilization of support responses. The second question, if it is such a bad habit, what can we do to avoid conversational narcissism? The first one, default focus to restrain your mind from wandering when you are listening. The second one, let your curiosity spark off your interest in discovering and absorbing new and unfamiliar pieces of information. The third one, honestly articulating your concerns when you stumble upon obstacles which disrupt the entire course of a conversation. The next one, maintaining open-mindedness. And the last one, give back the spotlight. And now, the third question. What should we do when we find out that our conversational partner is a conversational narcissist? A good conversation is like a game of cat. So, if you notice the tendency of the conversation to only greatly benefit one person and leave the other person feeling dissatisfied or unmotivated, then walking away is a necessary action. And be honest. And the last one. Why saying I know exactly how you feel is the worst? And why us being sympathetic can just be regarded as an extension of our subconscious tendency to enable conversational narcissism? So the first one, we do not know how they feel. The second one, each experience is individual. And the third one, most of the times it ends up with us talking about ourselves all over again. So that is our conclusion segment, and now I'm moving forward to a closing statement. It is just gonna be short. So having a good conversation is considered as one of the main priorities by many people, because a good conversation allows a person to tear down the barriers which limit his access to a broader and more inclusive understanding of phenomena. We often declare having a good conversation as something rare, something scarce, or out of reach. Like, I want to have a good conversation, but I haven't found the right person yet. Well, in one of the many TED Talks you did, Celeste Headlee stated that we are aware of what a good conversation looks like, and we are aware of how it feels like, and there is nothing prohibiting us from having it on a daily basis. So the main problem is not that we haven't found the right person yet. And yes, not every conversation you have is going to be insightful, is going to be interesting, is going to be eye-opening. But the first and foremost thing we should focus on is we should look into ourselves. Maybe it is us who should contemplate and redefine our knowledge pertaining to how to be a better conversationalist. Alright, we are at the end of this episode of One Awareness at a Time podcast, where we have talked about conversational narcissism. I want to say thank you to all of you who have stayed to the very end of this episode. I'm Arison, and this is One Awareness at a Time podcast. I'm gonna see you at the next episode. Bye!